it was the first time I had ever heard that you could get a degree in winemaking. And I said, that's for me.
Robert Parker has established himself as a critical reviewer with an acute palate. I'm just wondering where that female is.
The wine industry is addicting. It draws you back.
To me, the romance is in the glass, and it's when you're done with the bottle.
And we would spend our summer afternoons swimming in the irrigation pond for 3 to 4 hours a day.
Even though it's tough work, nobody said it would ever be easy. You know, we do it as a family.
In the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine.
Since I made Cabernet all my life at Behringer, I buy Cabernet, so should never let a winemaker own their own winery.
We were either going back to Switzerland to go to hotel school, or we were going to come to California. We had to get closer to the vineyard thing.
It's like when you go to one of those winemaker dinners where the winemaker doesn't quite get that not everyone is telling jokes about the acid level in the wine all night.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 82. This week we visit with Janie Brooks Hoik of Brooks Winery in Amity, Oregon. Every winery has a story, which is of course the reason why Life Between the Vines exists. But I have to say, Brooks Winery, which is located in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, has an unusual story, but not surprisingly, focused on legacy, family, and great wine. I spoke with Janie Brooks Hoik by phone just before Christmas of 2012, and I think you'll enjoy hearing her tell the Brooks story. It's likely we'll hear more from Janie in the new year. So what's the weather like out your part of the world today?
It is about to rain. Windy.
This would be rainy season for you anyway, right?
It is.
Well, I'm here speaking to Janie Brooks Hoik of Brooks Winery in Amity, Oregon. How are you doing, Janie?
I'm great, thank you.
And you were just telling me that it's just starting to rain out there. Have you had a heavy rainy season so far?
We have had a lot of rain so far. We even had snow the other day.
Do you normally get snow there?
A couple times a year, but nothing that's traffic halting or kids rarely get out of school.
Mm. Well, just to give our listeners kind of an idea, what part of Oregon were we looking at, north, south, east, west?
So we are about 45 minutes southwest of Portland in the dead center of the Willamette Valley.
And how long have you been there?
We have been in, the winery was established in 1998. I personally am from there, from Portland.
Jimmy Brooks is your brother and he started the winery.
Correct.
Okay, so give me a little bit of the history. How did, was he a big wine aficionado? How did it all start off?
You know, we grew up in the Portland area, and I would say, honestly, was not even familiar with the wine-growing region of the Willamette Valley throughout our childhood. It was nothing my parents were interested in, so it really was not part of our life. My brother ended up going to college and graduating from Linfield College, which is in McMinnville, which is also in the middle of the Willamette Valley, but again, really had nothing to do with the wine industry at that time. And once he graduated, he wasn't sure what he wanted to do for a living, so he bought a one-way ticket to Europe and traveled throughout Europe for about 6.5 years, finding different jobs and earning money and then traveling and spending it and finding the next job. And one of the first jobs he found was working harvest in Beaujolais. And he did that for 6 years in a row. And he ended up getting married and having a child while he was in Europe. And so they decided to move back to Oregon, where my parents were. And that's when he first took a position in the Willamette Valley as a vineyard manager for Willikensy Estate in 1996.
So he kind of got bitten by the bug, basically.
He got bitten by the bug, and I don't think he knew. I mean, I think he did over time that his own backyard was one of the best wine-growing regions in the world.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe fate sort of played a hand there that somehow it would find its way into your blood.
Yeah, and that it has, into our whole family's blood.
So as I understand it, Pascal is Jimmy's son, and he's considered the official owner of the winery, correct?
He is.
And how old is Pascal?
He is 16.
Okay. He looked a little young. How does that whole thing work?
So my brother worked at Willikensy, and he started Brooks, the Brooks label, while he was there in 1998. and was a real leader in not only promoting Riesling and making Riesling in Oregon, but also biodynamically farming wine grapes. And he had been consulting with a man named Mo Momtazi, who bought a 200-acre parcel in the Willamette Valley and was planting his vines. And Jimmy worked with him to farm them biodynamically. And Jimmy moved over there in 2000 to be their head winemaker. And while he was there, he grew Brooks to about 3,000 cases. And then unexpectedly, on a Saturday morning, September 4th of 2004, my brother passed away from an aortic dissection. And I was approached by a group of winemakers who wanted to continue the brand, thought he was doing some amazing things. So they asked me to help on the business side if they would help on the wine side. And so that technically was when my nephew inherited the winery.
I see. And my deepest sympathies, obviously it's been a long time, but I'm sure that had to be just about impossible to deal with.
Yeah.
So up to this point, though, you really had no major involvement in wine at all, correct?
None.
So you were kind of tossed into the business, if you will.
I was. And when I said yes, that I would help, I had no idea what he was doing. I had no idea about the industry. I quickly took a class online at UC Davis, which was just an entry point for viticulture and enology so that I could at least understand the terminology that was being used by different people in the wine industry. But I knew nothing except that I enjoyed drinking it.
Like many of us.
Yeah.
So now, obviously, it's been several years. I'm going to guess you're doing all right and you're pretty happy you made that decision to jump in, huh?
Very happy that I made that decision. You know, it's an industry that when I was first approached by this group of winemakers and they offered to help me for free, I had come out of healthcare and competitive healthcare for that matter and thought, who are these people that would be willing to help us? Aren't they my competition or Jimmy's competition? And realized pretty early on that the people that make up the wine industry are some of the most passionate, wonderful people I've ever met in my life.
I would agree sincerely with you, very willing to help each other out. But then again, too, you're talking about agriculture. These are farmers.
Mm-hmm, which is something I also had no appreciation for prior to this. You go into the grocery store and you buy whatever sounds good or whatever you would like to buy without any, I never had the amount of appreciation for what goes into farming.
Well, there's a classic phrase I've gotten from people in California where they say, where do your groceries come from? And then they look at you when you say, a grocery store? And they say no. So that does give you a different way to look at things. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Brooks Winery here and Brooks Wines, and then we're going to come back to a little bit more of the story here. You farm your own property, is that correct?
We have a 20-acre vineyard that my brother had been farming since 2002. That was half of it was planted in 1974, and then my husband and I purchased that in 2009. And that vineyard has 15 acres of Pinot Noir, 5 acres of Riesling, and is about 20% of our production. So we do source from 18 to 20 other vineyards every harvest, depending on the year.
And about how many cases are you outputting?
10,000.
Oh, so you're pretty good size then.
Yeah, we are now. We were 2,200 when my brother passed away, and one of the things that was super important to him was having his wines accessible. So his price points were always very reasonable, and we had to make the decision, do we keep the price points reasonable or do we grow production? Because we had a different overhead structure after he passed away, and so we decided to try to keep the price points where they were and to grow.
During the period of time when your brother was still with us, I mean, I know you said you enjoyed wine, but were you really liking, was this kind of thing like, my brother's a winemaker, this is very cool?
You know, I thought it was cool, and we talked a lot about the business side of it because he always had a vision of having his own building at some point and being out on his own and not having to work for anybody else. And he would send me wine from time to time, but I had no idea what kind of influence he was having on wine, on farming, on Riesling, and on people in general in the Willamette Valley.
Well, especially at that time, being biodynamic, that was still pretty new.
Very new.
And I'm impressed that you're able to carry on with that because it's certainly not an easy task.
Well, you know, we just finally received our certification just a few weeks ago, but it's effective for the 2012 vintage because we've continued to farm that way since 2002, and we had all the documentation and records, so we didn't have to go through the three-year wait period. And that's, you know, really, I wanted to keep that vision going, but the people who made it happen were our winemaker and our vineyard management service and some different consultants that we worked with.
Well, nice. Now, Do you have a tasting room?
We do have a tasting room.
And was this all part of the new cellar and everything, or was it, were they built at different times?
We moved into a building in 2008. So the years in between when Jimmy passed away in 2008, we were moving around in different custom crush facilities. But we moved into an old Brooks prune drying facility on the top of the Eola Hills in for the 2008 harvest. So it's a small old building that was built in the 60s. It was turned into a winery in the 80s and has remained one since then.
And then the tasting room came?
The tasting room has been there all along. Okay. And we were by appointment until this past Memorial Day, and now we're open Tuesday through Sunday from 11 to 5.
You know, you talked about your brother's travels in Europe. Did he have a different occupation long before that? I mean, before he became infected by wine, if you will?
You know, he was in school. He did work as a brewmaster for McMenamin, so he did have some involvement in producing, you know, beverages prior to, but no occupation per se. Really just different jobs to sustain his lifestyle.
Well, I hate to quote another cliche, but, you know, they do say it takes a lot of good beer to make great wine.
It does.
I had to go there.
If you find all you want after a long wine tasting is a cold beer.
I know, it's funny as heck, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, boy, it sounds to me that in the most noble possible way, you have really carried forward his dream, not only by increasing production, but again, staying biodynamic and really sort of sounds like staying true to his roots and his dreams.
You know, we really have, and a huge part of that is I call him my partner in crime, Chris Williams, who was my brother's assistant winemaker at the time my brother passed away. And he's been with me ever since. And he came over to Brooks with me really for the same reasons that I did. I wanted to continue this the way that Jimmy had started it and with his same vision and the same focus. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that I would have made some of the same decisions, but he left so much for me in terms of what his vision was by the way that he had established which wines he was making, how he was farming, what his price points were, what was important to him. He wanted it to be a family legacy because, you know, Brooks is obviously my maiden name. And Chris has been right there in the same spirit and really has not changed the philosophy behind the style of the wines at all. Mm-hmm. And that was what I was most concerned about because Jimmy's wines are a little different, a little bit edgy than what was going on. Had I used any other winemaker, I'm sure that over time our wines would have become more their style than ours.
I could see that would make a difference. Obviously, he learned in Jimmy's style, right? I mean, he was there.
Exactly, exactly. And Riesling is, there's about 35 producers in Oregon that make a Riesling, but we're really the only one who's kind of put all of our effort into having it be our primary white. Many people make Pinot Gris and Chardonnay, and that's what their primary white is. But we kind of hold the flag for making dry Riesling, especially in Oregon. And we now have 6 different Riesling labels. I'm on the board of the International Riesling Foundation. So, you know, our efforts to keep Riesling as a primary focus, which I would not say is the easiest thing to be out selling in the world. Mm. You know, was another part of what he laid out for me.
I think that's very cool. You know, number one, I think Riesling has had certainly a comeback over the last couple of years. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
And obviously due to the efforts of people like you who are trying to make this, especially a dry Riesling, something that people can understand a little bit better.
Yeah, I think there's definitely been some good efforts through a couple different programs, like the Summer of Riesling program that was started by Paul Greco in New York has really helped provide an opportunity for sommeliers to teach their consumers about Riesling. I think that the changes in the food scene right now with how experimental and different food is, people are more willing to try different wines. And with Riesling being such a great food wine, I think it definitely has helped to complement what's going on in the restaurant world throughout the country.
About how much, you said you had 6 different labels of Riesling right now?
We will have our 6th in 2012.
And about how much of your production is that?
About 2,500 cases.
Okay, so that's, you're talking almost a third.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good amount of Riesling.
Yeah.
That's a definite a faith in that particular varietal.
It is. And, you know, one of the things that the International Riesling Foundation did was they built a scale that just has four different markers. It's dry, medium dry, medium sweet, and sweet. And it's not just based on sugar. It's based on sugar and acid and then the relative pH. And it's on 30 million bottles now in the United States. We've put it on the back of our bottles since we could, since it started in 2008, with the efforts of trying to help the consumer understand what was going to be in their bottle. And we now have, across our six Rieslings, at least one that fits into every one of those categories.
To me, this really sounds like you're all about balance.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you got to have a lot of good acid in your Riesling.
Right, right. Are there some sweet that you make?
There are.
Okay.
There are. But I think people are pleasantly surprised with the amount of acid that are in our sweet wines.
And again, coming back to balance.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Let's talk about the Pinot. How many labels of Pinot are you doing?
We have six right now. I would say 80% of our production is in three of them that are priced at, you know, $20, $25, and $35. And then we do some reserves, and we've started to do maybe 100 to 200 cases of some single vineyards. Chris does all of the Pinot Noirs in really small lots. So he ends up with, you know, over 100 different Pinot Noir lots that he can blend back into those different labels, which allows him to do a couple things. If you're familiar with one of our larger labels, the style behind that wine is the same every year. It also allows him to achieve the balance that he's looking for within that style without having to manipulate the wines. And he really takes heart when he finds a lot that he thinks is super special, and he thinks in particular that that grower does a meticulous job in their vineyard. Mm-hmm. And likes to put their vineyard name on a bottle.
That's quite a compliment.
Well, and it is, and I appreciate that it comes from his appreciation of the grower. Mm-hmm. And not, you know, it's definitely not me saying we need to make some higher-end Pinot Noirs and charge more money, and let's make them single vineyard because those are deemed as being more hard to find and valuable. I love that it comes from his craft. And, you know, I get a little bit of question because we have 18 labels and we'll have 20 different labels in 2012. But I believe if he's as working as hard as he is to make pure wines, then I need to respect his craft and give him the labels that he wants to have.
I could see that as a winemaker finding opportunity by the grape you're working with. It's going to become about expression, and you're going to want to let that grape express itself the best you can, so that before it would become a different label, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, for many, you know, there's definitely the model of a winery where, you know, you can manipulate your wines as you see fit and create whatever kind of style. For us, we don't manipulate our wine. So whatever we do get from a flavor and a profile standpoint off the vineyard, you know, those are all extremely critical pieces.
Well, and I think most Pinot drinkers are looking for that, wines that are not manipulated. They want mm-hmm. something that is all about the grape.
Yep.
Especially coming from Oregon, because Oregon's become such a major producer of Pinot Noir, very highly sought after Pinot Noir, wouldn't you? I mean, no, you're biased. You're from there, but yeah. I mean, I think that's fair to say that.
Oh, I think it is, too. I think it is, too. And I think the, you know, we've been making an Oregon lower alcohol, brighter acid Pinot Noirs forever. And I think that that's a trend that's starting to continue throughout the rest of the country.
I think some people, and tell me if you would agree with this, that they might start with, say, maybe a Malbec or maybe a Cabernet, and as they become more educated, maybe they start leaning a bit more towards the Pinot Noirs because they start to understand the expression that comes from these wines, right?
Yeah, I do agree with that.
Well, I was looking through your website, and one label, of course, that got my attention right away, and you probably know where this is going, is the Runaway Red.
Uh-huh.
I love the label. I like your labels in general. Is that the one with Trotsky, I believe, on the cover?
It is the one with Trotsky. So, and my brother's the one that created all of those labels. So we've kept the packaging also intact that he originally created. But the story of the Runaway Red is a great one. Jimmy was at Willa Kenzie still as their assistant winemaker. He was only making 300 cases per vintage was what he was able to do there. And he wanted to come out with an entry-level Pinot Noir, you know, that was in the $20 to $25 price range, which really didn't exist in Oregon back in 1999. So he had his first barrel of that wine on the forklift, and it was after midnight, and he and our winemaker, Chris Williams, were together, and Jimmy came around a corner too fast, and the barrel fell off the forklift and rolled down the driveway into the creek at the bottom of the vineyard at Willikensy. And they heard a big splash, and they grabbed their flashlights and went running down there, and he was, you know, devastated, thinking that he had just lost, you know, a huge portion of his production for that year. And when they got down to the creek, they found that the barrel was actually completely intact.
Wow.
So they moved the barrel back up to the winery, and when he came in the next morning, somebody had hung a sign from it that said Runaway Red. And he liked the name. He didn't know what he was going to call it yet. And then he was very interested in Eastern European politics and literature. He actually, his wife is Polish, but he was living in Poland when he got married and had his son. And so he put Trotsky's picture on the label as a Runaway Red.
That's great. What a great story.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it might not be the label for everyone, but it definitely is something that characterizes my brother in so many different ways.
Yeah, it sounds like your brother was a bit of a character.
Yeah, he was a big character.
The karma thing. I mean, you'd almost have to name the wine something like that, wouldn't you?
Well, and he followed through with it as well. I mean, one of his last trips the summer before he passed away was to Mexico, and I have a picture of him at Trotsky's grave.
I didn't know Trotsky was buried in Mexico.
Yeah, that's where he ran away to. And he was killed with an ice axe, and so even on our label, it's an ice pick just because it's more obvious of what it is. And then the Communist Manifesto of Peace, Bread, and Land is on there, and Jimmy added wine to it. So that's on the label as well.
What a great story. I had no idea that's how he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
This is the end of part one of our interview with Janie Brooks Hoik. Download part two from lifebetweenthevines.com or by visiting iTunes.